Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is likely to happen in the political tug of war over federal funding, the Affordable Care Act, and the looming expiration of the debt ceiling? The contest is somewhat more complicated than other recent stalemates in Congress, in part because of divisions within the Republican Party over the best way to amend the Affordable Care Act or prevent it altogether. The Tea Party wing of the GOP has been a driving force in the current government shutdown, which initially furloughed 800,000 federal workers and still has about 450,000 of them sitting at home. The idea, almost no federal business gets done unless funding for the Affordable Care Act is stripped from the budget. And with the October 17th deadline for raising the debt ceiling looming, some observers are worried about the possibility that the U.S. Treasury might be forced to default on its debts. William McKenzie is an editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News, and he has been closely following events in Washington and their repercussions closer to home. Bill, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here, I think.
I fear that my first question could take you the rest of the hour to answer, but how did we get here exactly to using a government shutdown as a strategy to force yet another debate over enacting the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think the long-term answer is we're here because we have these two competing philosophies, and we, the public, keep electing people with very distinct points of view. So you've got President Obama with his Affordable Care Act, and then you have the Tea Party conservatives who don't want the Affordable Care Act. And so they're duking it out. So that's a long-term structural problem, if you will, of why we are where we are. Clearly, we're here at this moment because Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, Republican senator from Texas, decided to do what other Republicans were counseling him not to do, and that is to do this quasi-filibuster, last month where he's outlining he wants to defund Obamacare. And was threatening a government shutdown unless Democrats are willing to do that. So that's the short tactical reason we're here. Ted Cruz has pushed this issue.
You know, it's funny, Bill, when you talk about the idea that we have competing philosophies in this country. It is one of those hazards of democracy, right? We all love democracy, but we assume that we're always going to be in the majority.
Correct. Right. And I think our country changed. I lived in D.C. from 79 to 91. So when I got there, we were still in a New Deal, Great Society era. And then Reagan came in, and you could almost feel it. You could feel it. It was a palpable shift in the country. So we conservatism kind of took off. And I think ever since then, we've had this yin and yang between two different philosophies, and we can't quite settle in on a clear one going forward. So I think we are a center-right country. I don't think we're center-left. And so maybe that's why we're having these competing philosophies. And we're trying to, we elect a Democratic president who is not a new Democrat like Bill Clinton, who did try to bring, left and right together. President Obama comes out of, I would say he's a more traditional liberal Democrat with a practical streak in him. And then we got the Tea Party folks and Ted Cruz. And so you've got these people on the stage in Washington who are very different.
Okay, so a lot of ink has been spent, a lot of airtime spent talking about the Tea Party, but they are not a majority of the Republicans in Congress. So can you talk about why they seem to have so much power over people who have been, who are their seniors by many, many terms in the House and the Senate?
Well, I think what we need to talk about first, the House caucus, and I meant to look up the exact number of Republicans in the House caucus before I got here, but it's clearly over 218, so they got the majority. So most of those folks are going to be conservative Republicans. There is a caucus that one of our local representatives, Jeb Hensarling, led for a good while, which is made up of conservative members within the overall 218-plus Republicans. And most Republicans are part of that caucus Hensarling left. So most of them are going to be kind of where they don't want Obamacare. And so I think there is a strong nucleus in the House. But the question is, is Tea Party representative of the overall Republican Party? No, but certainly a sharp, outspoken faction of it. So that's one point. Two point is a lot of these Republicans who I would call maybe more mainstream Republicans or practical Republicans or in some case moderate Republicans, they fear being primaried during elections. So they fear that if they go too far out and challenge the Tea Party, then the Tea Party is going to run somebody against them in the next Republican primary. So, that's what some of them are against. I will say, and I'll stop here, in some of our recent state elections, some of the Republicans who drew Tea Party opponents in at either the congressional or the state Senate level, you know, the Tea Party folks didn't win. So maybe they aren't quite as muscular as they're made out to be all the time.
So let's talk again about Texas Senator Ted Cruz. You have followed his career closely. You have met and spoken with him. And you say, this is a loose quote, that he is essentially doing, he's like the poster child for what not to do as a senator. Why?
Right. Well, I'll give him credit on this. He did an editorial board interview with our paper last year, and he said, basically, if you're looking for a moderate, I'm not your guy. So you got to give him credit. He is arguing his philosophy up there. So that's what he is. But why he's a textbook case of not being the type of senator you want is because he's alienating his own party and his own caucus, you know, people who privately have, at least reports say, you know, have kind of gone after him in the caucus meetings. And publicly, you see people like John McCain, who called him a wacko bird, I think. And then you have others like Bob Corker, a senator from Tennessee, but, you know, who has publicly distanced himself, you know, from him. So what is he? Year one into being a senator. He's over every TV show you can imagine, every talk show you can imagine. He's out front, and he looks like he's in it for Ted Cruz to some people. He looks like for others like he's in it for his philosophy. But he just has this style, I think, that is irritating his own caucus. And you got to persuade people to do what you want them to do.
Do you think he has designs on running for the GOP presidential nomination?
You know, that I don't know. What you read is he does. I don't think you go to Iowa and New Hampshire the way he does. I don't think you seize the mic the way he does. Without having that thought in his mind. But, you know, I'm trying to think of the right example of people who just burn out too quickly, you know, and I think that's what he's doing.
So Texas,
I may be wrong.
Texas elected Ted Cruz. Yep. How are Texas voters responding to what's been going on?
Well, I think we continue to be a center-right state. And so what Cruz was able to do was win the primary against a more mainstream Republican, David Dewhurst, mm-hmm. in July of last summer, not this summer. So he was able to both ride and mobilize the Tea Party movement and win that primary against Dewhurst. And frankly, that's all he had to do because the Democrats still are not strong enough in this state to elect a U.S. senator. We'll see whether they're strong enough to elect a governor. But they aren't, you know, they weren't going to, all Cruz had to do is win that primary. And the way you win the primary is by being the most right-leaning Republican. So I guess what I'm saying is, yes, Texans elected him, but what really elected him was that primary.
So the shutdown is now dragging on. I mean, it's one of these situations where you can go without certain services and not really notice for a while. And then problems start to crop up. And even if the individuals who would be filling those jobs will receive back pay and they can sort of be assumed that they'll keep their homes and that sort of thing, no matter how long it lasts. I think about the backlog of work and the, you know, inconveniences it starts to affect people. Are Americans blaming Who are Americans blaming for putting all these people out of work?
Well, polls show that Republicans are taking it more on the chin. But here's my view, and I may be wrong on this. I think that those of us in the media are talking a lot about, you know, look here, these people are out of work. These government employees are out of work. I'm not sure that's what's going to resonate with most Americans. I don't think that's what's going to persuade the Tea Party folks. I think what will matter is if you stop getting Social Security or Medicare or if you start getting essential services. I think probably a lot of people will be affected by the close in parks, you know. But I'm not sure the trying to focus on the number of employees who aren't doing their jobs gets most people's attention. I think most people think this really isn't a way for our country to operate. We shouldn't shut the government down. Chris Matthews has a new book out about the days of when Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan worked together called Tip and the Gipper When Politics Worked. His point in one of these, his book, is we now have government by tantrum.
Of course, you cannot you can't really do much to Medicare spending or Social Security spending because they're not discretionary. I mean, would even the Tea Party jump onto that third rail if they could?
To reform Social Security and Medicare?
Not to reform them, but to stop those payments. If that wasn't being funded, I mean, I think that wouldn't last 24 hours before you
no,
have a serious
I agree.
Problem.
I think that would be the ultimate clash. And, you know, we won't. Wouldn't see that, I guess, until we get to the point where we can't raise the debt ceiling. And so, you know, but at that point, I think you would see people, you know, perhaps the more hard right Republicans start to back off. But, you know, we're talking about the hard right. On the other hand, we do have a president in the White House who, in my book, you know, he's not showing leadership. He's not getting down there and trying to really seriously work out a deal. And I think he is equally culpable in this.
What kind of deal would that be to say, okay, we will remove some of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act?
Right. I think, does he want to do that? No. I wrote a column about this yesterday. George H.W. Bush, back in exactly 23 years ago this month, signed a deal after months and weeks of arduous negotiations with Democrats. He signed a budget deal. After a temporary government shutdown, that raised taxes. Did he want to raise taxes? No, he didn't want to raise taxes. But he knew he had Democrats controlling both houses of Congress. And George Mitchell and Dick Gephardt, the leaders of those two houses, they weren't out there to do George H.W. Bush any favors. You know, they were sticking it to him every time they could get a chance. So, but Bush had to negotiate to get us to pass his budget deal. So clearly, President Obama doesn't want to negotiate with Affordable Care. I understand that. It's his bill. But there are there's one chamber of the Congress that is controlled by Republicans and a large number of Republicans, and people elected them. And people elected them in part because they don't like the Affordable Care Act. And polls show people don't. The majority of people at this point are dubious about the Affordable Care Act. So he's got these folks that he can ignore them. But he can't ignore them too long because we got the debt ceiling coming up to us, as you said, on October 17th. He knows he's going to have to deal with them at some point. So put something on the table. And there are myriad things you could talk about. Here's one idea. There's a proposal by a moderate Republican from Pennsylvania, Charlie Dent, and a moderate Democrat from Wisconsin, Ron Kine, that would extend the government for another 6 months on what's called a continuing resolution. And then meanwhile, you do away with this tax that Affordable Care Act has on medical devices. That's one of the ways they raise money to pay for the Affordable Care Act. And there are people in both parties who would like to see this tax go away. Okay, President Obama, talk to Boehner and say, all right, let's talk about this proposal that Dent and Ron Kine have.
My guest is William McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. We're talking about debt ceiling discussions, the federal government shutdown, and the battle for control of the GOP. We will continue the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dallas Morning News editorial columnist William McKenzie about the federal government shutdown and debt ceiling discussions and the Affordable Care Act. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, Bill, so John Boehner and Harry Reid reportedly had an agreement on a clean continuing resolution to keep the government open back in July. What happened to that?
Well, I think what happens is the August recess came, and whether it was real or manufactured, I don't know. But there was a lot of pushback in the August recess to the Affordable Care Act. And so Ted Cruz comes back in September, and that's when they go full bore with the defund the Affordable Care Act strategy, which is not a strategy that John Boehner, the speaker, had really pushed. And, you know, what we need to know about Boehner is he kind of comes from the deal-making school of politics. He is a conservative. I do not want to say he's not, but he is more of somebody who is a legislator, and in a good sense of the word, a legislator. He was one of the ones who worked with the Bush White House and Democrat George Miller and Democrat Ted Kennedy on No Child Left Behind. And whatever you think about that, that was a classic case of negotiation.
So, like, it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game is what you're saying.
Correct.
Is his philosophy.
Yeah, no, and that's kind of his approach. He is conservative. I want, again, underline that. So, but his theory, strategy was not to defund Obamacare. Cruz et al. Take over, and so Boehner is there. And some people may say, and I understand the argument, well, he ought to stiff his caucus. Fine. You stiff your caucus, you're out. And then the question becomes, who do you want? Do you want John Boehner, speaker, or do you want a real hard right Republican, maybe, you know, like a John Culberson from Houston or John Carter from Round Rock area, who've been pretty outspoken on a lot of this stuff, a Ted Cruz-like person in the House coming in a speaker? Because I think that's who you get.
Okay, so you have gone on record as saying you have serious concerns about the Affordable Care Act. And I ask this of you not to play devil's advocate, because I really want to know. I was trying to look it up online and I couldn't find anything. Do we know, when you talk about lots of Americans have objections to the Affordable Care Act, has anybody split those out into people who already have insurance that they like and maybe you're not inclined to want to pay money to help other people get insurance, and people who have no coverage and are sort of excited if they can ever get through the website debacle?
Right.
Has anybody looked at the differences in responses between those?
That's a good point. I don't know. My hunch is logic would tell you those who lack insurance are probably going to like it better than those who have insurance. My objections to it have been that the way it is financed over time is really scary to me. It's predicated in part upon $500 billion in Medicare cuts. And the administration claims this, you know, these will be done. We're already starting to do some. We've got this independent panel of folks who will be making these recommendations, and they have power to make them stick.
You think it doesn't add up?
I don't think Congress will stick with it. Congress has shown no wherewithal to stick by cuts to Medicare each time it comes up to adjust Medicare payment rates for doctors and physicians. They usually back off. I don't think Congress is going to go through with it. I hope they do. I will say that even the independent actuary who was doing some for, I believe it was the Center for Medicare Services, but I may be wrong. He's either that or for the Congressional Budget Office. In his analysis of it, warned the fact that these, you know, yes, this will be financed, but in so many words, when you read through what he's saying is Congress has never done this sort of thing before. So half of it is financed through means. I hope now the law is the law of land. I hope it works, but I it's not what I would bet on. Number two is I don't think it did enough to really what they call bend the cost curve. You know, it has various pilot projects in there that would help to control costs, but it really doesn't go very far into emphasizing enough ways to control cost. And as one example, it's still going to allow gold-plated health plans to remain up until, I think, like 2019, 2018. And that's something that the unions wanted. The unions like gold-plated health plans. And I should say that you get a tax deduction for those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so that's kind of costly. And there's also a thought that that's what one reason, that's part of the reason health costs gets driven up. So they're, you know, those are three examples. They're kind of wonky. I understand the exchanges. I don't have a problem with the health insurance exchanges. They're basically a market mechanism, and they're a smart thing to do. I think any health bill would have that. I don't have a problem with that. Personally, I don't really have a problem with the individual mandate because if it's going to work, you're going to have to require people to get it. I can understand the objections to it, but I don't think it's out of bounds.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now. We have Ann on the line in Richardson. Hello, Ann.
Yes. My question is, what is a caucus? How does it operate, and why does it have so much power?
Right.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, that's very good. Let's take the House. So the House has Democratic and Republican representatives. They meet separately in their own caucuses. So the 218-plus Republicans meet as their own caucus. They have their own meetings. They, you know, debate policy discussions. At the beginning of every session, they go on retreats together. Ditto with the Democrats. So they have their own caucus. Generally, what you find in the House is because most of these members come from seats that are considered safe, they're going to elect the most loyal Republican or the most loyal Democrat. You're going to find people who are going to be pretty conservative or pretty liberal. There aren't a whole lot of swing districts that are going to elect many moderates. So these caucuses tend to embolden the more extreme members of both caucuses. The Senate's a little different. You know, so you have 100 members. And Democrats control it. Republicans have a slight deficit. But because, A, you have fewer members, and B, senators are just more independent. And they also represent larger constituencies than just one congressional district.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Daniel in Dallas. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually wanted to ask about something that hasn't been reported much, and it relates to the assertion that the Democrats aren't negotiating. I read an article last week on, I believe it was the Daily Beast, that noted that the clean continuing resolution the Senate passed was actually passed at Republican funding levels, and that the Democrats wanted to fund the government for something like $1.70 trillion, and they passed it at over $100 billion less because Reid had been led to believe by Boehner that by doing that, he could avoid the Obamacare entanglement. And if I haven't seen that really reported anywhere else, and that's something that could dramatically change the narrative here.
Well, I don't think it dramatically changes the narrative, but he's right that the Senate Democrats this has been reported. In all these readings, I can't tell you where I've read it, but I've read it in the mainstream media and
I heard it was a $70 billion difference, but that's
right.
At this point immaterial.
Yeah. So they passed what's called a clean budget resolution, which doesn't do anything with Obamacare one way or another. It just is an extension of government funding for X period of time, but they would be extending the funding at levels that Republicans want. Okay, well, that's good. That's fine. That still doesn't deal with the issue that is on the table of the Affordable Care Act and what you do with that. And again, I think Cruz is wrong to pick this fight. The fight has been picked. And the issue is on the table, and there's a group in the House who've been elected by people, and they feel very strongly that this needs to be negotiated. I go back to what I said about Bush 41. He didn't want to raise taxes. He didn't want to negotiate taxes. But the reality was he had two chambers that he had to deal with somehow.
Okay, so, Bill, we have a big fist fight taking place in the living room, and it looks like the roof might just collapse at any moment here, or at least on October 17th.
Right.
Let's talk about the debt ceiling, which is not, we should stress, not directly related, am I correct, to what we're dealing with?
No, but thank goodness it's there, because in a way this is going to force an answer sooner than later. So the government has a limit on how much it can borrow, and it's 16.7 trillion is the limit, or debt. And so they have to we have to get an extension of the debt ceiling approved by Congress so we can raise borrow more money
more money to pay our existing debts.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And issue bonds, things like that, to be able to pay these off. We actually hit our ceiling, my understanding is, in May. So the Treasury Department, through means I don't understand, is able to kind of stretch this out over months. A colleague and I were talking about this. You know, you kind of wonder, does the Treasury Secretary turn to some guy down the hall and go, Frank, you got any extra money down there? But somehow they stretch this out. We're now at the end of stretching it out. Mm-hmm. So they have to have some extension approved by Congress. And I think this is going to force the hand.
So, you know, if you hear Chuck Schumer, this is economic apocalypse if we do not raise the debt ceiling in time. If you listen to somebody like Richard Burr today in the New York Times, maybe not such a big deal. How can we understand what the consequences would be of a default? And, like, could we do a default for a week without much harm, but a default for a month or 6 weeks absolutely collapses the financial system?
Well, I think we don't want to risk either strategy. So defaulting for a week is going to be better than defaulting for 6 months. But you do have people like John McCain, you know, who's been saying the same thing. He was quoted today saying, you know, people I'm talking to in the financial world, they're very nervous about what's going to happen. There are folks there in both parties who are concerned about it. Even Boehner said yesterday, he said, you know, I didn't come up here see a government default, you know, meaning up to Capitol Hill. I wasn't elected for that reason. So, you know, I don't think anybody wants this. I will say we already know once when we got right up the edge of that, either Standard & Poor's or Moody's one downgraded our credit rating.
They called our bluff.
Exactly. And I'm glad they did. And so this is, you know, we're the big kahuna in the world economy, and this will certainly embarrass us, but it also is a sort of thing is we lose leverage with other countries who are trying to get them to deal with their debt when we can't deal with our own.
Well, and there's a question as to whether investors start to think, are we the ideal reserve currency in the world if this continues to happen at an accelerating rate?
All right. So they may go back, though, to President Obama. All right, you see this coming, and Boehner too. You see this coming. The world's imperfect. You're going to have to figure out a way out of this and to deal with it. So Obama has said, look, you know, we're not going to do debt ceilings with some sort of contingency offered to it. Well, you know what? Debt ceilings have been extended a number of times with contingencies associated with them. This isn't unique to this environment. And this is another reason I think I understand what he's doing. He thinks that the Republicans are having a temper tantrum and he doesn't want to let them get away with it. Okay, I understand that. But guess what? That other side does control one chamber and you've got to figure out a way to negotiate this.
Is it a fair argument, though, to say, look, this is a law and it was passed by legal measures and it was, you know, approved by the Supreme Court in terms of its constitutionality?
Well, you can overturn laws. I think it is the wrong strategy. Again, I wouldn't have voted for Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to contradict myself all over the place, I guess. But I think it's a bad strategy to try to overturn a law, particularly as major as this, because Democrats will come right back at you and try to overturn your law if you're the Republicans. And this keeps going on and on and on. And we just have this unending cycle of payback. And for that reason, I would not want to see the Affordable Care Act just be assaulted. I'd like to see it be tweaked, but I wouldn't want to see it be assaulted like it is. I think it's just bad politics. But, you know, back in 1989 or 90, I think it was 89, Congress together passed a major health care act. That would offer, I think, catastrophic insurance, and seniors revolted. And within a year's time or 18 months' time, that law was gone.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go now to Reggie in DeSoto. Hello, Reggie.
Oh, hello, Chris. Another good show.
Thank you.
Your guess is, to me, no different than Ted Cruz, especially when you consider the fact that a number of hardworking Americans are being negatively affected by this shutdown, and the fact that millions of Americans will be negatively affected by defaulting on the debt ceiling. And I find it interesting that just because the Republicans can't have their way, they look at the rules and laws of the land differently. Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act is the law of the land. And if they want to see it repealed or see changes to it, they need to go through the proper procedures to not harm innocent people to try to get what they want.
What do you say to that, Bill McKenzie? I'll assume that you're going to take exception to being placed in the same box as Ted Cruz. But
I am in a different place. I mean, I wrote a column saying I think he was wrong on the defunding strategy and he's on a path to self-destruction. I don't like his style of politics at all. And so I'm not Ted Cruz. I think, though, you know, Republicans would argue is we are trying to go through a legal process to vote down parts of the Affordable Care Act. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to use the means that are afforded us to go do this.
Do you think some of the unwillingness on the part of the Democrats to, as you say, tweak the Affordable Care Act to make it palatable to at least the moderate side or the mainstream side of the Republican Party is a sense that if we can just get past that, the day one of the act, then nobody can touch it at that point?
Right.
Are we running out the clock?
Yeah. If I were a Democrat, that would be part of what I would be thinking about, that— You know, that once it's in law, it's harder to overturn or harder to get people to want to give it up. And I understand that. You know, you've got something you didn't have before. You don't want to get rid of it. So but if I were a Democrat, I would just want to look like I'm symbolically engaged in this discussion to say, OK, yeah, we can tweak it here. You know, for example, there's a provision in the Affordable Care Act that says that employers with 50 or more workers who have part-time workers 30 hours or more, they have to offer insurance to those part-time workers. Unions don't like that. Unions vote Democratic. Unions like the 40-hour work week. We already know places like Trader Joe's and others are starting to cut the number of hours folks are going to be working so they don't have to offer that insurance. Okay, here's another place. Negotiate something.
My guest is William McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. We'll continue our conversation of what's going on in Congress with debt ceiling discussions, with the Affordable Care Act, with the federal government shutdown. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is editorial columnist William McKenzie. He writes for the Dallas Morning News and is here to discuss the federal government shutdown, debt ceiling discussions, and a lot of other things taking place in Washington right now. You can be part of this by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Bill, I have another question. Mm-hmm. And I think many Americans supported the idea that furloughed federal workers will get back pay because people understand these people have, you know, families to support and houses to pay for, that sort of thing. But are we saving any money at all? Are we losing money having these workers sitting at home or mowing their lawns or
right,
whatever they're doing?
I've read this and I forgot the number. We're not saving a whole lot right now by doing this. We save some, not a lot. I mean, what the deficit the debt is, you know, in the high trillions and in the 16 trillion, and the deficit is fortunately under a trillion at this point. So, you know, whatever we save, it's going to be inconsequential compared to what the overall problem is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Dan in Arlington. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I just wanted to disagree with your guest just a little bit about whether or not we should or Boehner should bring a continuing resolution to the floor in the House. There's a reason, after all, that it's called the People's House. And if there are enough people in that House to produce 217 votes right now to pass this clean CR, then that's what the people should do, and that's what Boehner should let the people do.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Thank you so much for your call, Dan. It's been interesting, Bill, that Senator Boehner says, Speaker Boehner says that there are not the votes. Why not just put it to a vote and prove that?
Right. And I understand that. But the reality is he puts that to the vote. There goes Speaker Boehner. And so what you're going to get is somebody far harder than John Boehner is Speaker. And so I would say to those who don't like what they see with Boehner, well, wait till you what you get with somebody who's far harder than Boehner.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Gary in Arlington. Hi, Gary.
Hello, Chris. Hello, William. Good discussion. I'm a longtime Republican. I saw Ted Cruz's father speak at the Arlington Republican Club meeting about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
Critical feature, the Tea Party folks in the Republican Party right now are absolutely thrilled to death at what's occurred. If you go back and look at their campaign rhetoric, look at their paperwork, propaganda as I call it, you'll see that they're getting precisely what they wanted. But the critical thing to keep in mind is, besides, pardon me, their financial push, which truly probably needs to be done to some extent, the Tea Party is not just a party of finance or debt. Ted Cruz's father is an evangelical Christian. The Tea Party is a social party, and right now the debt ceiling and the finance program has overshadowed the fact that the social party, the same group that likes Texas State Senator Dan Patrick is pushing the abortion bills and things in the state of Texas, the evangelical right that pushes both Ted Cruz into office and Dan Patrick for Texas House. Watch out, folks, because this isn't just a finance party. Every time they use the word liberty in a Tea Party meeting, I wince.
What do you think about that, Bill?
Well, I think this tension has existed within the Tea Party for a while. I think it was pretty clear when it started. It was a financial, to use his word, financial concern driving most of the folks. They were kind of, I think, going beyond limited government to really kind of a disdain for government. And so, that's what was driving it. And Wayne Slater from my paper, I think, did some reporting on this early. But now, he's correct. You do have a number of people in there who are concerned about social issues, and this tension has kind of played out within the Tea Party for a while. I think there's an important moment here for Republicans, and if I go back to Boehner a second, having said I think he sacrifices his speakership if he lets that vote come to the House floor, and I do think that. But having said that, I think Republicans have a very important moment ahead of them because they need to have this battle internally within their party. Are they going to be the government party of limited government or the party of, and I'm being hyperbolic here, no government, people who hate government and disdain government? And there is a difference. And you see it at the state level. You see it a core group in the Texas legislature who will focus on core issues, whether that's water or education or transportation. And they believe we have to do those core functions right and well. And at the national level, I would say, deficit debts are part of it. Defense is part of it. Social welfare is part of it. You have to do those functions right. Doesn't mean you have to do them big. And so there's a difference between a limited government Republican and the anti-government Republican, and that battle needs to be fought within the Republican Party for the Republican Party's own sake.
What's the protocol by which a Speaker of the House is replaced? Do we just decide as members of the Speaker's party we're unhappy with this leadership and we're going to come together in a caucus and sort of overthrow?
Well, and in my memories, this is going to be off the top of my head, but remember when Gingrich was Speaker in the late 90s, mm-hmm. There was a coup against him.
Right.
As I recall, Dick Armey from here was one of his top leaders, but he was, as I recall, part of the coup. And so there are those trying to kick Gingrich out, and they didn't succeed at first. And then eventually Gingrich did come, I think it was then, and again, I'm winging this, there was then an election, and then the Republicans had a chance, I think, to come back in. And remember, they elected Bob Livingston for Louisiana as Speaker, and then he had a marital scandal of some sort. So out he went. And then that got us to Denny Hastert, mm-hmm. who then became Speaker. So, you know, I think the caucus can...
Speaker serves at the will of the caucus, essentially.
Well, of the House. I mean, he is Speaker of the yeah. House, and that's an important distinction.
But the minority has no right. real authority in deciding.
Right, right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Pamela in Denton. Hey, Pamela.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. I love your show.
Thank you.
I listen to it when I'm in the car a lot. This is the first time I've ever gotten through calling in.
Well, welcome.
I have questions and comments and opinions all over this question, but I want to focus on one thing that you said, Mr. McKenzie, a while ago about the device tax, the medical device tax mm-hmm. in the ACA. I haven't read what the specifics are about that tax, but I do know from personal experience that medical devices are grossly inflated. It's nothing near capitalism or free market. I have $123,000 billed in my body for a plate and 14 screws. Hmm. And I know, and I heard recently that a hip replacement costs is inflated about 100 times. And my joke was, when I got those bills, was, of course, I have insurance, thank God, but it was made on the space station. Wait, no, it wouldn't even cost that much. So isn't there room for considering some action about that? I agree with you wholeheartedly. The ACA does not address, in my opinion, the healthcare reform we need. It just expands the market, which is also needed for coverage. But with regard to these devices, as that one point you said he should compromise on that, what in your opinion is a good solution to address that, or should we just continue to let the charges and the costs run rampant and we have to pay what we have to pay?
Right. Well, the issue here on the table is whether you should lift the tax that the Affordable Care Act puts on manufacturers of these medical devices. And I don't know all the medical devices the tax applies to, but I do know that in Minnesota, represented by two Democratic senators, they were not wild about this tax, Al Franken being one of them. So, and there are a number of other Democrats who have said, yeah, you know, this is something they weren't really particularly thrilled about within the ACA. So it's a tax on the manufacturers of these devices.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I'm curious about, have you been watching the markets, and what do you think happens October 17th?
Yeah, you know, that's the beauty of the markets, and I love it because they can send a signal to Capitol Hill to say, in effect, we're bigger than you, and if you do this, this is where we're going.
We've seen quite a plunge.
Yeah, and we'll see a plunge, and you know, so the short-term interest rates look like they may be kind of not going in the right direction. So that sends a signal. And I'm glad it does.
We have an email here from Joe who says, this is all about impeachment. The GOP is going to force President Obama to act on the debt limit and then vote to impeach him. What do you think about that?
I haven't heard that.
800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Eric in Dallas. Hey, Eric.
Hey, how you all doing?
Great. Thank you.
Yes, I've been listening to you all. And I have a question. I would like to know, when did America first get in debt, and I would like to know how long we've been in debt. And I also would like to say that I'm starting to think that all the politicians are not in touch with reality. It's like they don't understand how America is being viewed, how it's hurting the American people. And I think that, you know, it's sad. You know, we look bad as a country to the world.
What do you think about that, Bill?
Well, I don't know exactly when the first debt occurred. I mean, going back to the beginning of the country, we had this argument about, you know, what we're going to do with our debts and how we pay our debts. But I think the key point is that the debt has risen so much over the last couple of decades. And so it's the growth rate of the debt that has been concerning. And so if you go find a chart, you'll see, you know, 25, 30 years ago, the debt was more manageable. It has risen for a number of factors, most recently because of the economy and because we, you know, we spent more to try to pump up the economy, and so it has continued to grow.
Far be it for anybody to classify you as Mr. Tax and Spend, but can you help us understand why raising tax rates is not part of this current discussion?
Well, it could become part of the discussion in the future. In the near term, because if we shift the discussion from Affordable Care Act to what do we do about entitlements like Medicare and Social Security, then you're going to have a discussion in there about taxes as well, because that's what's called the so-called grand bargain. Mm-hmm. You know, where both parties have an issue they want to put together in some sort of bargain. So Democrats are interested in taxes, Republicans are interested in entitlement reform. So you're going to marry those two together. I think the way you marry them together is what Reagan and Bill Bradley, Democratic senator, did back in the mid-'80s, is you have a reform of the tax code, which simplifies the tax codes. You simplify rates, have fewer rates, and you have what's called revenue neutral. Some rates go up, some go down, but the overall effect is no net tax increase. That's how I think you get something passed.
Where do you go to find your information and track all this?
You know, just read Wiley. I read our paper. I read the Washington Post online regularly, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. Today, Paul Ryan has a piece in the Wall Street Journal about a grand bargain or a small grand bargain, a way to get out of it. So I read, a lot of the mainstream media. I look at Concord Coalition website. The Committee for Responsible Federal Budget puts out press releases all the time. The Pete Peterson Foundation, which is all those three are kind of deficit-oriented groups that are pretty reasonable, very bipartisan or nonpartisan, trying to find ways that we can get off debt center.
Do you find it helpful at all to dip into like MSNBC and Fox News just to
No.
see what they're saying?
No. No. Oh, to see what I'm saying? Yes. But, you know, to some extent, after a while, you know what they're going to say.
So are you optimistic? Are you terrified about what's going to happen in the next
I wouldn't
eight
say
days?
Optimistic. Terrified, yeah. But again, what we talked about earlier, thank goodness the debt ceiling vote is coming up. It will force the hands. How this plays out, I don't know. In the past, we've always come up with some sort of compromise, some reasonable compromise. That's what happened in August 2011. Messy though it was, you know, we've seen spending, discretionary spending, cut some through that. And so we don't get there perfectly, but we do these train wrecks, if you will, force us to deal with things. So the market and the debt ceiling vote will force our hand.
William McKenzie is an editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, it is always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you
so much. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.